around and I tried the mid-size.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the Thursday, February 25th, 2016 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Today is an informational session on sudden oak death syndrome. And we have Peter Doherty and possibly others. I don't know. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. And certainly appreciate your being here and updating us on what is, at least in my view, very scary disease that if it's jumped into furs, we may have a real problem here. So thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon Department of Forestry's Private Forest Division Chief. And I'm here to provide an update on sudden oak death in Oregon's forest. And the first part of this presentation will be a little bit of a review of what we covered in June. Feel free to ask me questions, because I'll be going through that relatively quickly. As you'll recall, sudden oak death is caused by the non-native pathogen Phythophthora ramorum. In Oregon, it kills tan oak readily by causing cankers on the main stem. The name sudden oak death is a little bit misleading. It's sudden if you live 200 years old, but there's a lag period between initial infection.
Hear that?
Wow. Already with the abuse. That's horrible.
I mean, Craig, you think I was old growth or something.
But then you'd be protected.
So there is this lag period between initial infection and development of visible symptoms, and it may take months or years for an infected disease tree to die. And so this lag period is challenging for early detection and rapid response because the disease can spread during this period between initial infection and visible symptoms. Tan oak drives disease spread. It's highly susceptible and produces a lot of the spores that spread the disease. The pathogen has a broad host range of over 100 species, including several plants native to Oregon's forest, so grand fir, Doug fir, Oregon myrtle. But these trees only become infected when underneath or near an infected tan oak. There are multiple... Yes?
Excuse me. Grand fir, what families, you know, there's coastal white fir, there's a whole bunch of them. Are they all, do we think they all are going to be affected by it?
I know that grand fir is. I can check and get back to you on the other species. Okay. And again, these are foliar host, not boll host. So it can only infect the foliar, and that's true for Doug fir as well. So it doesn't get into the boll and it doesn't kill the tree, at least the lineage we have here now.
Okay.
There are multiple pathways for spread. You can get canopy drip from an infected tree for short distance intensification. There's wind-driven rain events, and that's how we get long distance spread. And then, of course, it can be spread by human transporting infected plants. The origin of the disease remains unknown. We do not know its native range of distribution. We have not been able to determine exactly how the disease got to Oregon, but it was likely the results of infected plants brought into Oregon from California. And there appear to now, we think there have been three separate introductions to Oregon. One in 1998 in Brookings, that was when we first discovered it. There was one in Cape Sebastian in 2009 and 2010. And then the most recent one is near Pistol River, and it was introduced in 2013, and I'll talk in more detail about that one later. That's our most recent introduction. We work cooperatively with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, the U.S. Forest Service, and Bureau of Land Management. Our program really has five components. Most of the original discovery of sudden oak death was done by aerial surveys with ground verification, but now we rely on multiple survey methods to detect new infestation. So we do aerial survey, ground-based transects, and we do stream baiting, where we monitor streams because it can travel in that. When a new infestation is detected, the site is treated by cutting and burning all host species, usually tan oak, rhododendron, huckleberry, and sometimes myrtle, and we treat within a specified buffer. A 300-foot radius buffer around an infected tree, usually 6 to 7 acres, has kind of become our standard treatment. But we've used buffers of 600 feet, which is 26 acres, and they're the most effective. On most sites...
So when you burn that all out, does that destroy the disease?
Yes, we have sites where we've completely eliminated the disease, and I have gone back and checked year after year. To give you some numbers, 50 to 60% of all sites that we've treated, we can't find the pathogen again. And now this is even in the soil, not in new trees. Okay. And on sites that we've treated greater than 300 feet, we're seeing 90% of those we have complete disease absence, at least from testing.
Thank you.
Peter, before you start in again, the photo in the upper left corner, there seems such a sharp line of demarcation between the infected site and what appears to be uninfected on the right third of that photo. What causes that, what looks to be a fairly sharp line to have been drawn between the two?
I believe the unit on the right is a regenerated unit that's probably all dug fir and doesn't have any host species in it.
You see the broader leaf. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. So, as I've said, we've learned eradication treatments can eliminate disease from a site and stop spread if we catch it early enough and we do appropriately sized treatments in a prompt manner. We've also learned that if infestations are not treated, the disease intensifies rapidly. In this image, all those gray and reddish-brown trees are dead tan oaks in an area where we've stopped doing treatments for several years. Mm-hmm. Leaving these large areas untreated also increases the probability of long-term spread because of increased inoculum, at least for a little while the disease intensifies.
Is that Forello Alder Creek country down on Southern Curry?
I can't. I didn't take the photo, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's in the what we call the generally infested area, which is an area we no longer require treatment under the quarantine. I'll review that. We'll get to that again in more detail where that is.
And this photo shows an interface. And is it human introduction? I mean, is that...
No, this is where the disease had spread and got ahead of us, and once we quit treating it, then you start getting that rapid increase in disease from right near adjacent trees, and it just builds on itself.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
So going back, remember the introduction was in 1998. We started our program of response in 2001. We had 9 infested sites, so it's a little bit hard to see, but it's this area down here, the white dots. So it was 9 infested sites in an area of about 36 acres. The quarantine was 9 square miles, and we treated 38 acres. If we treated that today at our standard, we'd treat more like 100 acres. Our initial efforts were focused on eradication with the idea of eliminating disease from forested areas. So we continued to treat, but by 2010, the quarantine area had expanded to 154 square miles, and the amount of disease exceeded our capacity to cut and burn all infested sites on non-federal lands. The BLM continued to treat all their lands, and some of the treatment delays leading to increased spread are attributable to gaps in available funding. But as I had said earlier, we also learned that our understanding of the lag between infection and detection was much longer than we originally thought, and our treatment areas were too small originally. And 2010 was a turning point for the program. There was too much disease to treat all of it with available funds, and we made a strategic decision to focus treatments on the outlying area to slow the rate of spread near the edge of the quarantine boundary and to leave other areas untreated. And so in 2012, the quarantine regulations changed in two ways. First, the quarantine area was expanded to 202 square miles. Secondly, it formally adopted a generally infested area. That's this red area in here, in which eradication treatments are not required. Everywhere else in the quarantine, they must be treated. And so this is the area that you see this very high disease intensification. That's where the photo came from. And so we have a SOD task force, multi-agency task force, that determines treatment priorities and adjust boundaries of the generally infested area. And treatment priorities are based on importance of slowing disease spread and then based on how much funding we have. This northernmost circle is the infestation I mentioned at Capes. Oh,
question from Vice Chair Krieger.
Peter, you're slashing this stuff, burning it. Are you treating the stumps chemically? Because all of the oak, the myrtle, and all that stuff, even if you burn it, all the bark off, it'll basil sprout and be back 3 to 5 years as tall as a man.
On most sites, we do pre-treatment. We do stem injections of imazapyr to prevent sprouting. It isn't done on all sites, depending on where it is, but we haven't seen the sprouts becoming reinfected. So if we eliminate the original tree, burn it, remove the pathogen from the sites, we're not seeing the sprouts getting reinfected because there's no source of inoculum. So, thanks. So the northernmost site is a Cap Sebastian, recently determined to be probable results of human-assisted spread from California. That was the second introduction we had. We did treat the site rapidly with a 900-foot buffer. 94 acres were treated. Much of this was on Oregon state park lands, and they were really cooperative with us. And the disease has been eliminated from the site, and it hasn't moved into the forest from that site. So this is a real successful story of catching it early enough. Yes.
Representative.
Chair, how much time did it take between the time that you identified and then treated, and how long has it been eliminated as far as you know?
Well, so it would have been a couple years lag. We think it was introduced in 2009 or 2010. We treated it in 2012. So 2 to 3 years between when we think it was introduced and when we treated it. But we treated it again very aggressively, 900-foot buffer around all infested trees. And we have not seen, since 2012, we have not been able to detect the disease on the site. So that's 4 years now.
And Peter, can you tell us how that pathogen is spread?
Again, it's related to water slime, so it needs wet conditions to spread. So fog or rain-driven storm events can move the spores a long distance. Locally, it spreads just from canopy drip. The spores can drop on down. And then this one was, again, somebody perhaps bringing a plant from California that was infected and it moved from the site by one of those methods.
Can wildlife move it? Birds stuff get on the bird or hoof of a.
We don't think that's a strong vector source. So this brings us this to the situation when we were here in June talking about this, you know, in 2015. This was the situation. At that time, our emphasis was on completing the treatments of the 14 infestations that were discovered in 2014 outside the generally infested areas. Those are the yellow circles, and you'll see we had these northernmost were the highest priority. One was actually outside the quarantine boundary, and these two were very close to the quarantine boundary, and that's what triggered the proposed quarantine expansion. These three most high priority sites were treated to the 300-foot buffer, and all other sites outside the GIA received some level of treatment, cut and burn and cut and pile infected trees with a buffer of 20 to 50 feet. So at this time, in June, we had discovered 11 new infestations in 2015 that were outside the generally infested area, and those are shown here in white. And then two more in areas that were also infected in 2014. We had started treatment on this one site on the Pistol River, and all other work was deferred into fall because of the high fire hazard in June, and we reported that. So I'm going to now move on to updating you what we found for the rest of 2015 up till now. So by the end of 2015, we found a total of 18 sites, so five more since we reported it in June outside the general infested area. And the 2015 in here are shown in yellow. One of the things to notice is none of these are further than the ones we had in 2014. And in fact, none of them are outside the previous quarantine area. And this is really good news. And while as much as we dislike the drought and it slowed treatment because of the high fire hazard, the drought is also likely the reason that it didn't spread as far in 2015. But in 2015, the quarantine was expanded to the seventh time. It's now 515 square miles, representing approximately 30% of Curry County. And I'm going to talk about a couple of key sites. There's this one down here, a very large site, about 50 acres. On the Windchuck River, just a mile and a half north of the California border. We've had excellent cooperation from the eight landowners that are in this area, and treatment on the site's about 90% complete. We were also fortunate. The Forest Service was very concerned about this site because of potential travel back into California, and they provided additional funds just to treat this site. And the other one I want to talk about is the Pistol River. I'm going to move to a more detail. Those are those two sites from the previous slide on the Pistol River. The southernmost infestation has the common NA1 or North American clonal lineage of the pathogen, and the eradication there is 90% complete. The northern one is different. This was a single small infected tan oak, and we had treated it at the time in June, but we didn't know. We got the DNA analysis from OSU and determined that this pathogen is a EU1, European lineage. And this is the first time this lineage has been found in U.S. forests. In all other cases where we've seen the disease, it's been this NA1 lineage. The infected tree was located 1 mile north of a small private nursery that was found by ODA to have been infested with the EU1 lineage in 2012. Mm-hmm. They did their protocol for treating the nursery, and the nursery closed shortly thereafter. But we believe this nursery is the source of that infestation. So this is the new introduction that I mentioned in 2013, mm-hmm. right around then. The discovery of the EU1 lineage is concerning on two counts. The EU1 lineage causes extensive damage to conifers in Europe, and especially on larch, and it's considered more aggressive than the NA1 lineage. The second reason is that it is a different mating variety, and it could mate with the NA1. Right now, we have clonal spread through asexual reproduction. If you do get mating, then there's greater genetic adaptability of the disease. So we received additional funding from USDA APHIS to treat this site, and it was cut and burned with a 300 to 400-foot variable radius. So on a single tree, we treated a very large area around it. Two post-treatment samplings of soil and vegetation have failed to detect any disease, and we'll continue to monitor that site regularly to sample and check for disease spread. So we believe we have eliminated it, but it's kind of a caution about new introductions, particularly a different lineage.
Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much.
Another
question. Vice Chair McLean?
The question I had was on these treatments, how expensive are these treatments, and how long do you think you have to monitor to know that you've actually eradicated?
The treatments are fairly expensive. They range from $3,000 to $5,000 per acre, and it really depends on the density of host species in the area that needs to be treated. Mm-hmm. We've been monitoring, and since we have the opportunity, we've just been monitoring sites to see how long, and I can get back to you, but I don't have a good answer for when we, say declare victory, because there could be a new introduction. But we do monitor sites, and we, to see if it is completely eliminated.
Representative Woodsett.
So you talked about sort of an outmating of, I think that was a term that you used, and I'm not really understanding how that happens genetically, if you will. I mean, normally they're restricted to a species or,
I'm sorry. I probably didn't express it clearly. These are two different lineages, and these pathogens have what they call different mating lineages. And so the one we have was introduced, and so it's a single clone, and it reproduces and spreads by spores, but it does that through asexual reproduction. Right. This new lineage could mate with the other one, so they could do sexual reproduction. I'm not a pathologist, so I don't know how water slimes mate. So if you...
well, it's just an interesting comment, because it's like, I didn't know they could do that. So is there any chance of these things, since they go to conifers and oaks and mating with, like, fruit trees? I mean, with something so they could...
No, it's just that it's kind of the difference between when you do asexual reproduction, right. There can't be any change in genetic material. It's right. The same genetic material right. That moves forward with this. If the EU1 became established and there was mating between the EU1 and the NA1, then there would be new potential for genetic material and greater adaptability.
That's what I was wondering. Okay, thank you.
Representative Gorsuch, followed by Representative Frederick.
So it sounds like NA1, our normal one, if you will, and that was from 98, right?
98, and then okay. Introduced again in 2009, 2010, and came to
So am I incorrect or correct in the idea that it's primarily focusing on tan oak? It can exist with Douglas fir and rhododendron and so on, but it doesn't necessarily kill those plants, right? The NA one.
That's correct. I think it can kill rhododendrons. It's okay. More susceptible, but for instance, it doesn't kill our Oregon myrtle. It can affect it, but it doesn't seem to kill that.
Is it follow up,
please?
Thank you. Does the EU1 then have the potential? Now it sounds like it's been contained, but would it have the potential to actually damage and kill Douglas fir?
We're not sure. We know okay. In Europe it's killed larch and okay. Other conifers, and it tends to be more aggressive.
Okay. But
Representative Frederick, followed by Representative McEwen.
This is just a personal sort of comment. This justifies my father's research for why he's been studying slime molds for his
yes.
Lifetime. So
yes.
This is one of those times when I go, yes, Dad.
Very good. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Two things. Am I to understand that if the two different strains crossbreed, it could produce a more virulent strain that could potentially be more difficult to eradicate? So the potential for greater damage would come if we have these two lineages crossbreed.
That is correct.
Okay. And to follow up on Representative Gorsuch's comment, and pardon me, I was gone for the first part of this, and you may have already said it, and if you do, I apologize. But I think one of the issues I remember from a previous hearing that we held on the issue of sudden oak death not killing our Doug fir or conifers, but the fact that it can live on them has the potential to create a significant issue with export of timber products.
No, and I haven't discussed that, but I will get to that shortly.
Okay,
that is a concern. So, it is listed as a host species.
So it becomes a bigger issue even though it doesn't kill the tree.
That's yeah. Correct.
Thank you.
And Peter, before you proceed, could you briefly touch on California's efforts to hold this at bay or in check, I guess?
Well, California has been treating in one or two counties, but generally they have not had an eradication program. So it has spread. I don't have comparison figures here, but in Humboldt County, where it wasn't treated and the conditions aren't as amenable for spread as it is in Southern Oregon, it spread 5 to 10 times as far in the same time period being untreated. So we know compared to that introduction, which was around the same time as ours, our program has really slowed the spread and contained the disease.
Thank you very much.
So speaking of currently on treatment status, the Forest Service has started treatments on all of their lands, and we have sufficient funds to treat all of the 2015 infestations at some level, but not to the standard treatment level. We do not know the amount of Forest Service funding we're going to receive in 2016, but the projections, it'll be more like the 2014 level rather than the 2015 where we got additional funds. And if we have similar disease level, that leaves us about $125,000 for eradication treatments.
Peter, another question or comment here.
I just wanted to make a comment that we did make a request in this budget cycle for
funds to assist with the eradication and control of this disease. Unfortunately, in our constrained budgetary cycle, it was not awarded in this current budget. But I think there are a number of us who are very willing to continue to pursue funding from other sources. I know the Coastal Caucus has made a decision that we will be trying to pursue and ask from other sources, so we'll see where we go with that. But we know this is an incredible, an important issue, and that time is wasting. We don't want to get behind the curve on this, so it's something that we will continue to pursue.
Thank you very much. And I know that you contacted my staff for information, and please feel free to contact me directly or my staff, and we can provide any technical assistance you need to help frame that request or refine that request.
I think a number of us recognize the importance of this, so thank you.
And yeah. Representative Gorsuch has something, followed by Vice Chair McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how much do you currently have to fight this?
Right now, for 2016, we're looking at about $125,000 for treatment. And if we had the similar level of infections, and we wanted to treat everything to 300 to 400 foot buffers, it'd be in the range of $500,000 to $800,000.
Follow up,
please.
So, would it be $500,000 to $800,000 above the 125, or that would include it?
Yeah,
so, if we brought it up somewhere to 500,000 to 800,000.
Yes.
All right. Well, I just want to echo what Representative McEwen said. Or is that McCowan? Anyway, I'm sorry.
I know
better. Bad representative. But it seems to me that this is an extremely serious thing, and we have a chance to keep it corralled. We really, I hope people are listening. We really need that money for this project, and I think we need it at the 800,000 level.
Absolutely. Vice Chair McLean.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch.
Well, every time I hear about a new invasive species or something like that, and I just start thinking about, you know, more stations, because it sounds like this problem we have, you know, California not treating, then that means that we're so much more vulnerable on our south. And just like, you know, the boats coming out of the waters with all the little creatures that are coming up, and we're trying to get those stations to make sure we clean them up. It just feels like we need to have some kind of a study going on talking about how do we protect the borders from all these invasive species. And I know there are systems in place, but they don't sound particularly efficient. And so I'm hoping that maybe this next year we can have some dialogue around how do we try to keep some of this out of the region so we can, you know, someone will have some healthy trees and plants and waters.
No, just to kind of remind you, we do an aerial survey of all forest land in Oregon on an annual basis, and that's how we originally discovered. We just saw tan oaks mortality during our aerial survey. We did ground checking, and we noticed the bole cankers and realized there was a potential that this was sudden oak death, and we worked with OSU to verify it. So we do have an annual survey to really try to help on some of these detections. And for some of the other key invasives that we're worried about, like emerald ash borer, we are working with the Invasive Species County Council in looking at ways to try to get early detection in case we got one of those insect pathogens in.
And Vice Chair Krieger had a comment.
Peter, I understand there's a test area they've done with a spray, a certain type of chemical?
Yes, sir. Why am I drawing a blank? Fungicides. So we did do a little testing. It isn't really an effective technique from the air, but the people have been systemically using fungicide to protect individual landscape trees. And so if you put a fungicide in the tree prior to infestation, it appears to protect the tree. It's pretty costly, and it needs to be repeated maybe every 2 years. So it's really only good to sort of protect important landscape trees, perhaps. And we believe it's been successful. So,
yes. is this the same thing that the Forest Service is thinking of doing or experimenting with on some sites that they want to do? We've Commissioner Smith down there had talked to them of something they were going to do.
I'm not aware of that, and I can follow up. Okay. I would have, if just to, for a little bit of clarity, my staff is currently in Curry County now meeting with U.S. Forest Service leaders, a new director of the National Forest Health Protection Group from the U.S. Forest Service, to really emphasize the importance of continuing federal funding on this or increasing federal funding. So some of these questions we can get back to you, but that's the reason they're not here today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Please.
Mr. Chair. I think you're going to talk about this, but we were talking about, I think Representative McEwen brought up the question of, like, Christmas trees or, you know, maybe towards the idea of Christmas trees. Since the main way to treat this is to burn it, what do we do to make sure our Christmas trees are okay to move somewhere else, to sell somewhere else?
There is a quarantine protocol if you're growing Christmas trees in the quarantine area. If you follow ODA protocols, it requires annual testing and watching for visible symptoms, and you're able to ship those out of the quarantine area. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Great. Kind of moving on in terms of containing this disease, and it is now well established in Curry County, and we don't believe we can eliminate it given the size of the generally infested area. But the risk, and that's on the left side, is really driven by the distribution of can oak. And so here's the quarantine area, and you can see that there's a lot of red, which is the highest risk. Orange is moderate. Yellow is moderate. Orange is high, and red is very high. And so you'll see where the disease was introduced in high-risk areas. The black dots are infestations over the past 5 years. So spread has been predominantly northward. So it was first introduced here. It's been moving northward, close to the coast. That's a wind-driven rain events, and to some lesser extent up the Chetco and the Windchuck rivers. So the Chetco and the Windchuck, possibly because of fog moving up those river valleys. Much of the area to at risk up in this area is private land. So the blue is private industrial lands. And I'll make a note here. You'll see that we, just before it gets to Coos County, there's a lower risk area right near the border, and there may be some opportunity there to be more effective at slowing the spread. And so the last time, we've been developing alternatives for how to move forward with the program. It's still under considerations by agency and stakeholders. And as Representative McEwen said, was concerned, many of the stakeholders think it's a top priority to keep it out of Coos County and the regulations that go with it because of potential loss of domestic and international markets. While Doug fir is not a boll host, it is a host species, and countries can use that as a way to say we are not going to accept your logs, or your logs need to be kiln dried or some other higher expectation for shipping. And so we've talked about different alternatives, transition to living with the disease, so continuing to monitor it but to stop treatments, continue the current slow the spread program as funded today, or continue it with more complete funding. And then the fourth is really to think about how do we contain it to Curry County. And one of the components is, you'll see this sort of action area that's delineated right along the boundary where, you know, the idea there would be to have some sort of an emergency fund available that if we either got a new EU1 or an infestation in this area, we could rapidly move to treat it very aggressively to kind of stop it at that boundary limit. And so why, and again, we want to protect tan oak. We are, just to be clear, we are continuing the slow the spread program. We think it has value, and it is slowing that movement towards Coos or Douglas County. And we will continue to do that, given the funding that we have. And we'll further develop in the alternatives to inform this policy discussion about next steps. And so we want to protect tan oak and other forest ecosystems at risk, and we also want to evaluate the potential cost to nurseries and forest product industries as this disease progresses. So thank you very much.
Peter, thank you so much. Obviously, you've garnered our interest with the number of questions that we've asked, and I think it's a reflection of how concerned this committee is. I think we can safely say that we have the support of this committee to provide the funding that is necessary to keep this in check. Are there other things while you're before us that you think perhaps we should be considering in terms of any assistance we might be able to be to the department in your mission in trying to keep this in check?
I think your interest and support of, as particularly as we bring forward potential alternatives to evaluate and weighing the benefits and the cost of those alternatives,
yes.
I think that will be very useful. And I think that we're working on those now, and I think it would be appropriate late in the fall at one of the sessions to come back and update you on where we're at and progress on those.
Okay. Very good. Vice Chair Krieger.
Peter, in a canyon like that right now, you don't have any water, but if you expand that to a larger stream, do we have anything in the forest practice rules about how close you can take this type of activity? A forest company or myself can only cut down to a certain length. You got those riparian zones, 50, 100, whatever they are?
It isn't going to be a barrier because we always have a plan for alternate practice where the plan for the outcome, if it would be a better outcome. And so we have treated tan oaks in riparian areas and treated them to the extent of removing all host trees in there because the benefits to slowing the disease outweighed the risk to the riparian areas. That's been a little bit more challenging, but we've even done that on federal lands where we've treated infestations within riparian management areas.
Thank you very much. Other questions or comments? Well, Peter, I want to thank you ever so much for this presentation and making sure that this is in the forefront of our concern. And again, if there are things that this committee can do to be of assistance, please don't hesitate to contact us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the informational session on sudden oak death syndrome, unless there was anyone else in the audience who had anything to offer. Seeing none, I'm going to close that informational session. For the good of the order, committee members, you'll note that we have a happy hour scheduled for House Ag and Friends. So, audience members, that includes all of the frequent flyers here to our hearings. You'll note that the invitation is
thematic with some of the issues that that we've covered in this
very
committee.
Nice.
Not what's happening.
And yeah, I was going to say, is the marijuana?
No. That is industrial hemp.
That's hemp. That's
oh,
hemp.
Oh,
industrial
oh.
hemp. That's the same right. number of leaves, yes. Representative, but
that's how I was fooled.
But a different
and cows, of course.
Whatever.
Cows.
Non psychoactive.
There you go.
Psychoactive. But maybe that's why we have contented cows. I don't know. And then the
easy milkers.
The backdrop, of course, is sky lanterns. So, and I have my intern in my office, oh, Lauren Bullis, to thank for the design of the invitations. So
nice.
We'll be getting more of these invitations out shortly. I have a stack of them here that I'll leave on the door as people go out. But we would love to have people join us for a social event on Tuesday.
Are you buying?
From 5:30 to 7. We're going to have, I'm not sure it's a limitless host, but there is some amount of host involved in this. So with that, anything else for the good of the order?
No. Thank you, Chair Witt.
Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. I'll leave some of these in the back of the room.
I think